Kenneth Moore reports on how the hardships of the Great Depression were reflected in popular song, a period when Fred Astaire and Ethel Merman were first becoming Broadway stars. And in Britain, the post of dance music director of the BBC was passing to a relatively unknown bandleader called Henry Hall.
By the time the bottom fell out of Wall Street on Black Friday, October 1929, it had already been obvious to millions of people for a very long time that that land fit for heroes that the politicians had talked about so breezily 10 years before had never materialized and wasn't ever going to. The Wall Street crash might have induced a few bankers to take a dive out of their office windows, but the man in the street hadn't been having it good for a very long time. Very often the war hero found he wasn't even employable. And by the start of the Hungry Thirties, the songs were beginning to reflect this disillusion. And one song in particular, written by a then obscure lyricist called Yip Harburg. Harburg was later to win an Oscar for his words to Over the Rainbow. But in 1930, his hit song dealt with what was at the end of the rainbow.
That's right, the Brother Can You Spare a Dime song, I mean, came right out of the what I was feeling then for everybody. It was a song that just captured the whole depression. It was a time of bewilderment. And the question that the man asked in the lyric, I didn't try to make this lyric a handout lyric, please give me a dime. It wasn't that. It was a fellow asking a very important question. The reason the song is important is because it's really a sociological statement rather than a crybaby lyric. It isn't that. It's a, I built a railroad. I built a tower. I fought your wars. Why am I empty-handed? I produce, why don't I share? This is what made the song important, I think. It was the way it was handled. It was handled poetically. It was handled so that it made a bigger than an individual statement.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower, up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suit, ah gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Bing Crosby, of course. Buddy, can you spare a dime? Tells the story of the male who's come on hard times, but what about the female of the species? In 1930, Rodgers and Hart produced a song with a remarkably graphic lyric, whose brilliantly ingenious rhyme schemes, for instance, hero with queer romance and so on, partly obscured the fact that the song was oozing with social realism of the toughest kind. And that wasn't quite to everybody's liking. To name one, the singer Tony Martin.
10 cents a dance. That reflected in those days upon a poor girl taking 10 cents just for a dance, you know, in a dance hall. Brother, Can You Spare a Dime had to do with the bad times. Most songs were related. A Cup of Coffee and You, Button Up Your Overcoat, you know, things like that. But I would say I personally have been bad off, and I don't want to listen to bad off songs. I want to hear happy songs.
10 cents a dance. That's what they pay me, gosh, how they weigh me down. 10 cents a dance, panties and rough guys, tough guys who tear my gown. 7 to midnight, I hear drums, loudly the saxophone blows. Trumpets are breaking my eardrums. Customers crush my toes. Sometimes I think I found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All that you need is a ticket. Come on, big boy, 10 cents a dance. Fighters, sailors, bow-legged tailors can pay for a ticket and rent me. Butchers and barbers and rats from the harbor, how sweetheart my good luck has sent me. Though I've a chorus of elderly beaux, stockings are porous with holes in the toes, I'm there to closing time. Dance and be merry, it's only a dime. 10 cents a dance, that's what they pay me. Gosh, how they weigh me down. 10 cents a dance, handies and rough guys, tough guys who tear my gown. 7 to midnight, I hear drums, loudly the saxophone blows. Trumpets are breaking my eardrums, customers crush my toes. Sometimes I think I found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All that you need is a ticket. Come on, big boy, 10 cents a dance.
Ruth Etting, 10 cents a dance. And so, what with the all-American woman hiring herself out in dance halls and her male counterpart walking the streets looking for work, it didn't sound like a very promising environment for romantic songs to be thriving. But the irony is that as the whole Western world slid into a slump which it never escaped from until the full employment of the Second World War, some of the very finest popular songs of the century were pouring off the presses. When you run your eye down the list for the years 1930 and 31, for instance, time and again you stop and realize that there is such a thing as a pop song that isn't perishable goods. Now, we've just heard how the dance hall had become the new focal point of working-class life in the cities. But in the same year, Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz used dancing to produce an even more unusual article, a popular song with philosophic pretensions.
We're working, Dietz and I, on a show to be called The Bandwagon, without a story, only a review. In those days, reviews were very popular. So one night, at Dietz's house, he said, I want us to write a song that has a meaning more than a romantic meaning, that says something more than, darling, I love you, something about man's existence. And I don't want to be pompous about it, but let's try to think of a mood for such a song. And he had a library, and Howard went from book to book on his shelf looking for ideas for titles. And he came across a book which was called Dancers in the Dark. Yes, that's it. Dancing in the Dark. I got his meaning immediately. I said, you mean that in a sense that all of us are dancing in the dark? He said, yes, that's what I mean. So I'll try to write a melody for that. And I left him, and I went home. It was then very late at night. And I went to the piano, and I played this melody as if I had known it all my life.
Dancing in the dark. Dark, and it soon ends. We're warm. the light of a new love to brighten up the night. I have you, love, and we can face the music together, dancing in the dark.
Vinnie Hale singing the song that was written for Fred Astaire to dance to in The Bandwagon. Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz were lucky to get Dancing in the Dark off the ground so easily. Sometimes the course of true love songs didn't run quite so smoothly, even the very greatest love songs. In all the annals of popular music this century, no standard ever had to contend with so many cloth-eared impresarios or so many leading ladies with septic egos as The Man I Love. The calmest man on that subject, as on so very many, turns out to be the man who wrote the lyric, Ira Gershwin.
It was written for Adele Astaire and Lady Be Good. And after the first week in a tryout in Philadelphia, it was taken out because it seemed to slow up the show, which was really a dancing show. And although Adele did it most acceptably, the management felt they didn't need the song. But Edgar Selvin was crazy about it, and he said, I want to use it when we were doing a show called Stack Up the Van, 1927. And it didn't do well in that either. As a matter of fact, that version of Stack Up the Van only played 2 weeks out of town. And then Ziegfeld wanted it for Rosalie, which starred Marilyn Miller and Jack Donahue. And I had to rewrite the lyric of The Man I Love to suit Marilyn Miller. That also didn't make the show. Here's a song that was in 3 shows and never came to New York. But the publisher, Max Dreyfus, had faith in the song, and he said, look, if I spend a little money on this, if you boys will take the center copy less, I'll do some work on it. And I remember Lady Mountbatten, who was a great admirer of my brother's, and she took a copy of the song back to England, and it was played there, and little by little, it became a hit.
Come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love, and when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. At me and smile, I'll understand, and in a little while, you take my hand, and though it seems absurd, I know we both won't say a word. Maybe I shall meet him Sunday, maybe Monday, maybe not. Still, I'm sure to meet him one day. Maybe Tuesday will be my good news day. You build a little home, just meant for two, from which I'll never roam. Who would you? And so all else above, I'm waiting for the man.
The peculiar adventures of The Man I Love raises the interesting question, why should so indisputably fine a song as that have so much opposition before winning through? Surely its merit should have been obvious to everybody, even to the people who produce musicals. Well, what we're inclined to forget sometimes is that in musical comedy, the music came last in order of importance. Costumes, sets, lighting, the stars, dressing room, all were considered more important than even the best song.
It was around this time that Jerome Kern wrote one of his most original and, incidentally, most durable compositions. It was a good song, and when you hear Arthur Schwartz's description of what it had to contend with, you can see it had to be good to survive at all.
Kern and Hammerstein wrote this show, and there was this big melody which has emerged. It was 1932, and it opened on election night when Roosevelt was elected for the first time, and nobody paid attention to the great notices the next day, and the show was a failure. But this song, called "The Song Is You," was sung in this way on the stage. It was thrown away as if it had no value at all. Let me tell you about it. First of all, Tullio Cominati was not a singer. He was an actor who could barely sing. He sang this song to Natalie Hall, who played the part of a prima donna. While he sang it, Marjorie Main, who became a movie star of a character type, who played the part of a maid to Natalie Hall. Natalie Hall had on a costume with great big ruffles and hoop skirts, sort of. Marjorie Main was on the floor with pins and threads and was trying to repair the bloomers or pantaloons underneath the skirt. All during the singing of the song. The audience never heard the song. Now, why was it done? Because they felt they wanted to play the scene rather than the song. The fact that the song ever emerged is a testament to its greatness.
Song Is You, one of Jerome Kern's masterpieces. In order to write songs like that, Kern used to sit at the piano all day, carefully working out the most cunning and unexpected melodic patterns. But that wasn't the way every songwriter worked. In 1930, an unemployed singer called Harold Arlen got himself a stopgap engagement as rehearsal pianist for a new Vincent Heumann show. What followed was unprecedented.
I was hired by Vincent Heumann's to be an actor-singer in Great Day. And during the rehearsal, Fletcher Henderson, who had the orchestra, took ill. And Vincent asked me to play for the cast, for the ensembles. And I played the piano. And before each song, I would play the usual vamp that we all know. There was a traditional vamp that went like this. Da-dum, da-dum, dum-dum. Then I would improvise. One day I did da-dum, da-dum, dum-dum. Another time I went da-da-da-da-dum, da-dum, dum-dum. And the cast wanted to know what it was. And I realized I had something there, and I developed it into a theme. And Harry Warren, another songwriter, introduced me to Ted Kohler. And that's how I happened to write my first professional song, Get Happy.
Forget your troubles and just get happy. You must shoot all your blues away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. get ready for the judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Now, hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're going to the promised land. We're heading across the river, wash your sins away in the tide. It's all so peaceful on the other side. If the judgment and just gets happy, you better shoo all your blues away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day.
Get happy. Harold Arlen's first and certainly least premeditated hit. Perhaps an even greater song was the one first published in 1931, which made its impact through the charisma of the lady who sang it. The song was Body and Soul, and the lady's name, Libby Holman, and the man who dreamed up the lyric, Edward Heyman.
At a social event, I met Johnny Green, and he was looking for a lyricist, and we decided that we'd try it. And we wrote a show about tennis called No Love. And a lady in New York was going to back it. And we had done the entire score, 16 songs. And she suddenly backed out. And we were left with all these songs and nothing. And one of those songs was Body and Soul. And nobody liked anything. And that song in particular, they said, you can't write a song, and this was 1931, with the word body in it. It's impossible. So Johnny remembered when he was at Harvard, he had done a big favor for Gertrude Lawrence. And she said, if there's anything I can do for you, please let me know. So in complete desperation, he called Gertie, and she came over, and she heard all 16 songs and said, I really don't think they're good at all, but I like that one called Body and Soul. And she bought herself an interest in that song. Today her estate still gets money from Body and Soul. And she took it immediately to Libby Holman, who had made a big success in a song called Moaning Low from The Little Show, and Libby hated it. Then Max Gordon, who had was going to do a show called Three's a Crowd, heard it, and he said, this is the perfect song for Libby Holman. So he sent it to her, and she went wild about it, didn't even know it was the same song she turned down from Gertie Lawrence about 6 months before.
My heart is sad and lonely, for you I sigh, for you, dear, only, I haven't you seen it. I'm all for you, body and soul. I spend my days in longing and wondering why it's me you're wronging. I tell you, I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul. I can't believe it, it's hard to conceive it, that you turn away romance. Are you pretending it looks like the ending? Unless I could have one more chance. My life a hell you're making. You know I'm yours for just the taking. I'd gladly surrender myself to you, body and soul.
Libby Holman singing Body and Soul. By the early 1930s, there were one or two other areas now superseding the musical theatre as the place to get your song played. Recording, for instance, was beginning to hint at its enormous future. The movies were mustering in on live entertainment, and, less obvious but highly influential, the jazz world was starting to make its presence felt in the way songs were played and interpreted. In 1930, there was a very unusual example of this when, for a moment, the antipathetic worlds of jazz and musical comedy reached out and actually touched for a moment. The trumpeter, Charlie Teagarden, was directly involved.
I left to go with Red Nichols in the pit of a Gershwin musical comedy called Girl Crazy, which was a big hit. And I left the band because Benny Goodman was going to be in this pit band, and I always wanted to work with Benny on a steady band and hadn't had an opportunity to up to that time. And Gene Krupa was the drummer, and Girl Crazy was another drummer that I always wanted to work with. This is a show that had I Got Rhythm, Embraceable You, But Not For Me, Biding My Time, had a beautiful score. And the star of that show was Ginger Rogers. She was about 18 or 19 years old at that time. And although she had done one other Broadway show in front of this, this was the first show she was really a star. And this was also Ethel Merman's first show, first musical she ever did. She had a supporting role in Girl Crazy, and needless to say, she was a tremendous smash. The big number in the show was I Got Rhythm, which was arranged by Glenn Miller. Glenn did the arrangement on that. It was the finale of the first act, and this was one of the first times that a real swinging band had been used in a Broadway pit.
Charlie Teagarden remembering the Gershwins' Girl Crazy. Ethel Merman, not unnaturally, remembers that show, too.
Vinton Friedley came over to the Brooklyn Paramount, heard me sing. Unbeknownst to me, I did not know that this famous producer was out in the audience. Called up my agent. My agent and I and Vinton Friedley went up to see George Gershwin. Mr. Gershwin played I Got Rhythm. He played another song called Boy, What Love Has Done to Me. He played another song called Sam and Delilah. I was fortunate enough to get the job in Girl Crazy, and I wound up singing those three songs. And, of course, getting I Got Rhythm to sing was history, overnight history.
I got rhythm. I got music. I got my man. Who could ask for anything more? I got Daisy in green pasture. I got my man. Who could ask for anything more? No man's trouble. Say I don't find him, but you won't find him round my door. I got starlight and I got sweet dreams. I got my man.
Was one way a song could become a great standard, by getting into a Broadway show where the music was played by experienced jazz musicians. Another way was to get your piece performed by a great star in the movies. But here, a slight difficulty occurs. Most of the movie moguls, unlike the tycoons of Broadway, had no showbiz background to speak of. That's to say, they had a background, but they'd rather not speak of it, and neither would anyone else. Now, these producers employed the great songwriters without really having much idea of the quality of the goods they were dealing with. And that's a theme which becomes especially obvious in next week's edition. But even now, we can guess something of the difficulties put in the movie songwriter's way from what Leo Robin remembers of the great big hit he wrote for Maurice Chevalier.
In the early days of musical pictures, there was a period when you had to write what they called the theme song of the picture. There was one picture called Woman Disputed, and some fellows actually wrote a song called Woman Disputed, I Love You. Well, it so happens that in this Chevalier picture, the girl's name was Louise. And that was that. We had her write a song called Louise. And thanks to Chevalier, it became very important.
Wonderful, oh, it's wonderful to be in love with you. Beautiful, you're so beautiful. You haunt me all day through. Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Earth in the trees seem to twitter, Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little bit that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Every little breeze seems to whisper, Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter, Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, I love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you, it's joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise?
Maurice Chevalier, with a Richard Whiting, Leo Robin hit, Louise. One of the songs from the film Innocence of Paris, it was the first musical step in Chevalier's climb to international stardom. It was also just one of dozens of outstanding items from the song plugger's catalogue of the period. But is there one all-time great song from the years 1930-31? Something so well loved that it even pushes out songs like Dancing in the Dark and Body and Soul. Well, the general opinion is that yes, there was one song of 1931 which may perhaps be the best popular song ever written. Certainly, by the end of the decade, it was the song that had inspired the most recorded versions, something like 300 different ones. The song composer was Hoagy Carmichael.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you when our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. Oh, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song beside a garden wall. When stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew, though I dream in vain. In my heart it will remain my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain. Melody, the memory of love's refrain.
Stardust, sung, played, and whistled by the composer. The tune was in fact written by Hoagy Carmichael in 1929, but not known to the public until words were put to it by Mitchell Parish 2 years later. Carmichael is something of an odd man out among the big songwriters of the period. He came neither from the conservatories like Kern, nor from the theatre like Rogers or Porter, nor from the world of song-plugging like Gershwin. He appears, as a matter of fact, to have drifted into songwriting by accident, and because of his exposure at an impressionable age to jazz. A Midwest college boy who struck up an early friendship with the great cornetist Leon Vic Spiderbeck, Carmichael has often testified to the debt of inspiration he owed Vic. Indeed, if you play the melody of Stardust at twice its normal speed, what you end up with is something very like a Vic cornet solo. But it was, ironically, in this very year of 1931, in August, that Vic, riddled with consumption and still leaking bootleg hooch, died. He was just 28, the first patron, the first romanticized martyr in jazz history, and idolized by Louis Armstrong as well.
I told you about Bix when I first met him. It was his Davenport Highway, and we had to go up to Davenport to get the steamer GS out of that chute. That's where they keep the boats all winter, and that's where I met Bix. He came on the boat. Then I met him again in Chicago with Paul Whiteman down at Chicago Theater, and I was playing at the Sunset for Mr. Joe Glazer. And after the show's over, he come up, and when the 4 o'clock come, we close the doors, and Bix and I sit down there, and music for hours, blow so beautiful, and played the piano. And he didn't know how to say no, and he didn't know how to say good night. So them well-wishers, oh, man, must they love him, you know, but they're doing him harm. Still saying, well, go get a little sleep there, maybe 3 or 4 hours and come back or something, out or something. They didn't tell him that. He was just a young man.
Leon Vic Spiderbeck, a jazz trumpeter who played for a while in the ranks of the Paul Whiteman Band, and that meant that for a while his path crossed with that of the man destined to become the biggest name in popular music for the rest of the decade, Bing Crosby, the man that lyricist Leo Robin wrote at least one hit for that's still remembered today.
While I was on the Paramount lot, a young fellow who was the piano player and sort of vocal coach came over to me and said, look, I have a chance to write a couple of songs for a picture that Paramount is planning, and would you write the lyrics for me? Well, I had nothing to do. I said, sure. Well, the fellow happened to be Ralph Ranger, with whom I later teamed, and we were very lucky together. But the first song we wrote together was a song called Please, which it turned out was to be sung by Bing Crosby.
Please, lend your little ear to my plea. Lend a ray of cheer to my plea. Tell me that you love me too. Please, let me hold you tight in my arms. I could find delight in your charms. Every night, my whole life through, your eyes reveal that you have the soul of an angel white as snow. How long must I play the role of a gloomy Romeo? Please say you're not intending to tease. Speed that happy ending and please tell me that you love me too.
Please was only one of a whole series of recordings that Crosby was now making, which were rapidly putting him on a different plane of popularity altogether from all previous local heroes, even Joss. When the world heard this, for instance, in November 1931, it went so weak at the knees that it was all it could do to rush out and buy the record.
Why must I live in dreams of the days I used to know? Why can't I find real peace of mind and return to the long ago, where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day? Someone waits for me, and the gold of her hair crowns the blue of her eyes like a halo tenderly. If only I